This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. The big news story making headlines in eastern North Carolina and around the nation this week is the long-awaited decision by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They have announced that they will continue their nearly 30-year conservation effort of the endangered red wolf in northeastern North Carolina. But some conservation groups aren't happy with the announcement. After a nearly three-year peer-reviewed evaluation of the Red Wolf Recovery Program and the non-essential experimental population, a revamped management plan was announced Monday afternoon. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Southeast Regional Director Cindy Doner outlined the plan in a media conference call, which shifts the focus of their conservation efforts to the captive breeding program.
We must essentially double it to at least 400 wolves. Currently, there are slightly more than 200 in captivity. We must nearly double the number of healthy breeding pairs to a minimum of 52.
Currently, an estimated 45 wild red wolves remain in Beaufort, Dare, Hyde, Terrell, and Washington counties. Under the new plan, the service is proposing to revise the existing experimental population rule to only include the Dare County Bombing Range and Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge. Assistant Regional Director for Ecological Services, Leo Miranda.
If we get to a final decision on completing that rulemaking process with one county NEP, then the animals that are outside that one county NEP will be removed and incorporated into the captive breeding population.
The announcement is drawing criticism from conservation groups who fear the new plan could drive the world's only population of wild red wolves to extinction. President of Pamlico Albemarle conservationist Attila Nimitz.
Having a captive breeding program continues the genetics of the red wolf, but at the same time, the spirit and law of the Endangered Species Act is that there has to be wild populations.
Other groups, including the Southern Environmental Law Center, Defenders of Wildlife, and Wildlands Network, agree that FWS is abandoning their obligations to protect the red wolf in the wild. Conservation scientist Ron Sutherland with Wildlands Network.
It sounds like a compromise, maybe at face value, but it really represents giving up the idea of recovering red wolves in the wild in eastern North Carolina.
The service did say that they will begin searching for new sites that can support experimental wild red wolf populations. FWS Southeast Regional Director Doner.
We are committed to red wolf recovery. I am committed to red wolf recovery. We said that from the beginning.
The next step, Doner says, is an environmental review, followed by a significant opportunity for citizens and stakeholders to comment on the proposal. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Another big news story from our area gaining national attention was this week's announcement of college championship boycotts from both the NCAA and ACC. Governor Pat McCrory paid a visit to a group of Charlotte business leaders this week. The governor addressed those decisions and his views on House Bill 2, which caused the boycott. But as Tom Bullock of WFAE reports, McCrory's tone was more telling than his answers.
McCrory began his remarks to the Hood Hargett Breakfast Club by saying this appearance has long been on his schedule, but...
I didn't anticipate walking into the firestorm that continues to be directed toward our state.
In response to House Bill 2, then McCrory told the crowd to, in essence, buckle up or head home.
If you're expecting a politically correct speech or if you want a politically correct speech, you might need to walk out right now.
The governor then shifted to talk about what he sees as a positive for the state, the economy, his Carolina comeback.
And North Carolina have right now the fourth fastest growing economy in the United States of America.
Then McCrory pivoted.
The definition of politics by many is the art of diversion. And there are some people who want to divert the attention away from the incredible success that we're having here in North Carolina.
And here is where McCrory's tone is telling. In the past, boycotts have earned his ire. After the NBA pulled the All-Star game from Charlotte, the governor derided the elites, the sports elites, media elites, and business elites for what he said was their hypocrisy, for still doing business and playing games in countries like China. This day, there was some of the promised tough talk about HB 2.
It's not going to be resolved by North Carolina legislature. It's not going to be resolved by the city of Charlotte. It's not going to be resolved by the ACC or the NCAA who meets in private behind closed doors with no transcripts of what they've done.
But then McCrory's tone changed. It seemed conciliatory. His words asked for patience. This debate over gender identity, McCrory said, will only be settled by one group.
It's going to be decided by the Supreme Court, and it deserves a Supreme Court hearing because it's a very, very complex issue.
Now, that doesn't mean McCrory is ready to call a special session to repeal the law. When asked if he could go back in time and do anything differently during the 12 hours HB 2 went from bill to law, McCrory answered only he wished he could have done more to stop the Charlotte City Council from passing its expanded non-discrimination ordinance in the first place, which Republicans say is why HB 2 was needed. When asked at what point he would support taking another look at changes to HB 2, McCrory said he's tried.
I've never stopped working on a compromise. I had a compromise deal with the Charlotte City Council probably 4 or 5 months ago, and your mayor killed it.
The Charlotte City Council voted it down back in May. McCrory continued.
I had a compromise deal with the NBA, and I had some people in my party and the Attorney General kill it.
For the record, the NBA said the proposed changes to HB 2 that were circulated earlier this year would not go far enough. As for the Attorney General, Democrat Roy Cooper is, of course, running against McCrory for the governor's office. Cooper has called for HB 2 to be repealed, and he talks to the same group of Charlotte business leaders next week. For WFA News, I'm Tom Bullock.
As Election Day approaches, political rhetoric is getting tenser. Even relatively innocuous stories from the campaign trail seem to ignite heated arguments. At times, those strong disagreements play out at public forums, social gatherings, or family get-togethers. Chris Thomas has this.
So, you're at the office, or you're around the dinner table, and then it happens. The conversation turns to politics.
There has been many a family gathering in my family where the subject was dropped.
Mary Tucker McLaughlin, a communication professor at ECU and former news producer.
Because people just did not agree, could not agree, and, you know, it was problematic.
She said, in her experience, people don't usually go there unless it's an election year. Unfortunately, this is an election year, and an especially contentious one at that, with Eastern North Carolina in a swing state, and an especially controversial one at that. Subjects that start heated arguments between loved ones or colleagues are in no short supply.
And so people like to share their views. There are tons of ads out there. There are things happening with the candidates every day. And of course, people want to talk about it.
She says that's not necessarily a bad thing. Diverse discourse about politics should be encouraged. Claudia Sundnan is a Greenville resident. She's appalled by the lack of civility.
It's been terrible. I've never seen our country is so terribly polarized. We're just at opposite ends of the spectrum, and people aren't listening to the other. We're just into our own selves and just not listening to the other.
Compassion, she believes, is a missing element in the conversation.
We are not only not talking to one another, but we're not understanding one another.
It harkens back to the long-held belief that a person cannot talk about politics and religion in polite company. Brad Lockerbie, a political science professor at ECU, believes it speaks to an underlying matter, morality.
People feel a little bit more strongly about those than other issues that are more negotiable, that you can compromise more easily on economic policy, spending, taxes and such. You can split the difference, but it's hard to split the difference on abortion or prayer or gay rights.
Lockerbie, a professed political junkie, enjoys talking policy and theory. But when things become overly acrimonious, that's when it's time to walk away.
If the conversation can't be restored to a level of amity or calmness, I don't feel like I have an obligation to take part in it.
There are times, of course, when that's not always an option, unless you want to further strain a key professional or personal relationship. Sometimes you just have to grin and bear it, unless, of course, something else should come up.
It's always good to just redirect the conversation if it's not going in, you know, in a pleasant direction, and if people are going to be upset.
That shouldn't be too hard. Diversity is a defining trait of the national culture, and Dr. Lockerbie believes there's usually another topic to grab everyone's attention.
most of us don't let politics animate our lives entirely. We have other interests, whether it be sports or just simply tending to our family, that takes precedence over politics.
So, how does one leave point A and move to point B? Sometimes that may require clever thinking, finding a word or phrase related, even loosely, to another, more pleasant topic, and bringing that up instead. If that window's too narrow, then perhaps a more direct and proactive approach is needed. Before things can get too heated, it may be worth reminding everyone where their priorities should lay, Dr. Tucker McLaughlin says.
You know, you can also talk to family members about the importance of just listening to each other, not interrupting, not pointing fingers, not making arguments and discourse personal, but making them about facts and about what's out there. And you know, sometimes that helps. And other times you just have to set it aside and say, this is just not something that we can discuss right now.
If that doesn't work, then one may have to retreat into one's mind for relief. Amy Bright, an ECU student and activist, tries to remember that we're all people here.
I always try to remember that everybody is a human being and everybody has the same general human characteristics regardless of which side of the aisle we reside on. And what that means is that we're all complex. We're not good and bad. We're all somewhere in the middle of that.
And for those of you who may be itching to bring up those polarizing subjects around the Thanksgiving turkey or the water cooler, perhaps you should take a word of advice from Glenn Hubbard, one of Dr. Tucker McLaughlin's colleagues at the ECU School of Communication.
Is this hot topic that everybody's so up in arms about, is it really that important for me to say my piece about?
November 8th is Election Day, but that doesn't mean political conversations end November 9th. This election, on all levels, has dug into raw, emotional parts of the electorate's psyche. No matter who wins, the conversation will continue, and it may not always be pleasant. But you may have the ability to turn the conversation away from hostility and toward civility. I'm Chris Thomas.
Last week, North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory announced that the state is seeking federal approval to designate a section of U.S. 264 as a future interstate. The 72-mile segment of highway will extend from the U.S. 264 Highway 64 split near Zebulon in Wake County and run through Nash, Wilson, Greene, and Pitt counties all the way to Greenville. This week, I spoke with State Transportation Secretary Nick Tennyson on what this designation could mean for eastern North Carolina's second largest city.
Interstate actually has the same characteristics as a lot of roads that we call controlled access. In other words, you cannot get onto them except at designated points, on ramps, no stoplights, no possibility of traffic crossing the path of the interstate. What it means is that it's a part of the highway system interconnected across the United States that meets a certain level of safety and performance standards to be able to carry the nation's trade in a rapid manner over long distances.
How much work will it take to bring the stretch of U.S. 264 up to interstate standards?
There are projects we would need to do to widen the shoulders. There are some bridges that where we need to deal with specifications about the height, the clearance height for the bridge or the width. Overall, though, it's a controlled access facility the whole way, so it's not as much as some of the other conversions would be, you know, in a transition like this.
Do you have an estimate as to how much those changes would cost?
Yeah, we think it's approximately $100 million at this point.
When Governor McCrory made the announcement last week, he mentioned that Greenville is the state's largest metropolitan area currently not served by an interstate. Why hasn't the state considered this project until now?
I think that what we would find is that there are a number of routes across the state that we've been focused on trying to make sure that we were keeping up and that we were trying to make sure that we completed the pathway. For example, 40, which was extended down to Wilmington, was an attempt to make sure that we had a route all the way to the coast. This section of highway certainly has received a lot of attention. I mean, that's why it's as close to being interstate level as it is now. But as to the designation, what I think you'll find is that local requests and the desire on the part of the people that are in that area plays a big role in making sure that things like this are accomplished.
What kind of response have you received from businesses and city officials and residents in Greenville?
Universally positive and hopeful, looking toward the future. They are all, I think, aware that this is not a task that's accomplished overnight, and I don't think anybody is operating under the concept that just putting in this application necessarily immediately will translate to a sign or even to the road being improved, but very, very positive feedback.
Now, what would this interstate designation mean for Greenville economically?
The main thing about this that economic developers talk about, and that I certainly heard from leaders in Greenville, is that access to an interstate designated route is a primary item on the checklist for site developers who are looking for locations to have facilities built or to locate new businesses. And so this will put Greenville in the position of being able to have a check in that block.
I understand that NCDOT is submitting an application this week to the Federal Highway Administration and the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. When do you expect to hear back?
Well, the decision ordinarily is considered at the annual meeting of that American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, which will take place in the middle of November. So we could get an answer then. Although we have had in the past experiences with interstate applications that have been held over for an extra consideration or an extra cycle. So the earliest I would say we would hear would be the middle of November.
I'd like to ask you about another section of highway in eastern North Carolina that received interstate designation earlier this year. The future interstate on Highway 70 will run east of Raleigh to Morehead City and connect with the port. Can you talk about that project?
We have got two designations in the eastern part of the state. The one you're talking about is along Highway 70, and that's what is referred to as future Interstate 42. So that one's been assigned a number. And that certainly will help, not just with the port, but it will help with the port because all along that corridor, traffic has to deal with the various traffic signals and the disruption to the flow of traffic that translates to. We've completed a few bypasses along there, the Goldsboro bypass, of course, being the current favorite for folks that are headed to the beach, but that will definitely make freight flow more freely along that corridor.
I'm speaking with State Transportation Secretary Nick Tennyson. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, thank you.
I wake up every morning to Morning Edition, drive home to All Things Considered. Anything on Saturday, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, You Bet Your Garden. I'm not a gardener, but I love to listen to You Bet Your Garden. I'm certainly not a cook, and I love to listen to The Splendid Table, George Olson and The Sound in the evenings when I'm out in my workshop. Down East Journal, too. There's really interesting reporting. It's very local. It gives me a window into a lot of different stuff going on in eastern North Carolina. Think about all the hours that you spend listening to that. You know, you can become a member of Public Radio East very inexpensively. I had been listening for free for way too long and decided that I needed to start supporting the station if I wanted to continue listening. I am Barbara Brown. I live in Trent Woods, North Carolina, and I am Public Radio East.
The leaves look like clover, but the flowers tell a different tale. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss what to do when you let wood sorrel make you sorry you thought it was a purposeful plant. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
You Bet Your Garden, Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. On PRE, Public Radio East, news and ideas at 88.5 in New Bern, 88.1 in Greenville, from Kinston to Raleigh at 90.3, and at the coast at 91.5.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. For years, I've been hearing about a new insect that may become a problem on crepe myrtles in North Carolina, the crepe myrtle bark scale. Unfortunately, this insect was identified for the first time in our state in August. The first detections were in Iredell and Wake counties. So far, these insects haven't been found in the coastal plain, but we need to be aware and on the lookout. The crepe myrtle bark scale are from Asia, which is also where crepe myrtles originated. These insects have been in the United States for several years, but until last month, the closest known populations were located in Tennessee. The movement of this insect is bad news because crepe myrtles are typically a tough, low-maintenance tree, but trees infested with crepe myrtle bark scale will require pest management to stay healthy and beautiful. Scale are small insects that live and feed on plants, but they're not easy to recognize as insects. Scales are circular to oval, wingless, and they lack a recognizable head, legs, or other body parts. So they look like a little bump on the plant. They're also largely immobile, staying in one place and feeding on the plant by sucking sap from the vascular system. In the case of crepe myrtle bark scale, their waxy outer coating makes them look white. So light infestations will look like small white bumps on the bark of the tree, while heavier infestations can look like felt mats. As they feed, the scale excrete large amounts of honeydew, a sugary liquid, which coats the leaves and limbs of the crepe myrtle. This leads to the development of sooty mold, a black fungus that grows on the honeydew. Most people will notice the black sooty mold before they notice the scale insects themselves. Now, just seeing sooty mold on crepe myrtles doesn't mean you have crepe myrtle bark scales. Aphids also cause sooty mold development. Unfortunately, control of crepe myrtle bark scale is going to be a challenge. Crepe myrtle bark scale probably moved initially on infected nursery plants, so be careful to avoid buying and planting infested crepe myrtles. Inspect plants closely before you purchase them. Once crepe myrtle bark scale are found in the landscape, careful choices are going to need to be made in regards to insecticide use. The initial recommendations included the use of systemic neonicotinoid insecticides. We now know that these insecticides, if applied in such a way that pollinators are exposed to the residue when collecting pollen and nectar, can negatively impact our pollinator populations. We're going to have to be very careful when choosing and applying pesticides. For homeowners, dormant oil sprays will probably be the best suppression option, but research is still ongoing and further recommendations will come the more we know about this insect. While this pest has not yet been detected in our area, I urge you to keep an eye out for it. If you think you have this pest, please contact your local extension office. Your agent will be happy to help confirm the diagnosis and provide recommendations for control.
Here's an event happening right here in eastern North Carolina and you're not going to want to miss out on. The North Carolina Coastal Federation is hosting their Ride for North River and Barn Party.
This is Sarah King, Development Director with the North Carolina Coastal Federation. This is a family-friendly event out at our wetland restoration site down near Otway. It's a 6,000-acre farm that's been restored to wetlands, and it's a really beautiful site and a great place for a barn party. There's a cycling event starting at noon. It's an off-road cycling event with a 7-mile loop, and you can do multiple loops or just do one. Then there is a 5K run and a 1-mile fun run that starts at 2:30, and then the barn party is from 3 until 6. There's a little something for everyone at the barn party. We will have a clam bake with fresh local clams and live music from the Beaufort Band Always Right. We'll have hay rides for the kids, some massage and stretch sessions for anyone who's feeling a little bit tense. We also have some live animal displays from the North Carolina Aquarium and the Outer Banks Wildlife Shelter and the Trinity Center. One of those includes a baby alligator, which is adorable, and I'm pretty excited about that. Kitty Hawk Kites is coming, and they're going to have kite-making sessions out there, so it's great for the kids to come out and make their own kites and then fly them that afternoon right there on site. It is Saturday, September 24th. The events start around noon. The farm is located off of Highway 70, about Plain is outside of Beaufort. So it's right off of 70, just after where you would turn to go to Harkers Island. For more information on this nonprofit event, visit the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.